Yeah, thank you for a very enlightening talk. Next speaker is Mike Casey, who will talk about parallel transfers in audio. So, please.
Thank you. If I stand here, can you see me? Yes. Is the spotlight? Yeah, great. Let me see if I can find my PowerPoint. At this particular point in history, sound archives have a particularly large problem. And I think it's a problem that this audience is probably very aware of and knows quite a bit about, so I won't spend a lot of time with it. I can sum it up using just three words: degradation, obsolescence, and numbers. That is, we have very large numbers of audio recordings that are actively degrading, carried on formats that are either obsolete or will be very soon. On our own campus in Bloomington, we have over 360,000 audio recordings. At my own home unit, which is the Archives of Traditional Music, which we call the ATM, we've been doing that well before ATM took on its present meaning. We're not a cash machine, unfortunately. We have 110,000 recordings. Well, we ran some numbers recently, and we figured that if we have one audio engineer doing preservation work at the ATM, and if we used a typical one-to-one transfer workflow, that is, one audio engineer doing one recording at a time, that it would take us 60 years to digitally preserve our collection, with the following caveats, of course. Do we have 60 years? I don't think so. Most archivists, or I should say many archivists, believe we have 15 to 20 years to do this work. And it's really the task of our generation to get this work done during this upcoming 15 or 20 years, less for some formats, until we reach the point where, because of the combination of degradation and obsolescence, it either becomes impossible or prohibitively expensive to actually do digital preservation work. What should we do? Well, we're addressing this at a couple of different levels. One is at an institutional level. We've realized that our unit is not going to get our own stuff done, and we need help from our university. That's another topic entirely. It's a topic I'm going to speak about at the ARTS conference here in a couple of weeks. But we've also taken a look at this from within our own unit and tried to understand a little more clearly what we can do to maximize our own efficiency, to increase throughput, so that we can get more done within the same amount of time. And so we've conducted an efficiency study. This has been done under the auspices of the Sound Directions Project, which is funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities in the United States and is a collaboration between Indiana and Harvard universities. I do need to point out that the R&D work that I'm going to speak about here has been done just on the Indiana side of this project. So we conducted a somewhat formal efficiency study with some help from a consultant, Chris Lesinek at AVPS. This work also benefited greatly from conversations with George Blood at Safe Sound Archive over the course of several years. We've also had the model from Harvard that we can bounce off of in terms of looking at our system. And we basically have done work in two areas. One is automation, that is adding software scripts to do the easier kinds of things, the things that we don't need human beings to do. That also is another topic for conversation. I'm going to focus on our work in what I call parallel transfers. And let's define the term first. Different people use different words or combination of words to describe this. I use the term parallel transfers. What I'm talking about is simultaneous digitization of multiple sources. So you're digitizing two cassettes at a time, or three cassettes, or eight cassettes, or whatever it might be. What's the big deal? This is used in broadcast archives quite a bit, has been used for a number of years. Broadcast archives tend to have more homogeneous collections, collections that tend to be very similar. Tapes recorded by professional engineers, they have tones at the head, for example. You kind of know what to expect throughout a collection like that. I work in a research archive, which holds a range of formats from wax cylinders all the way up through, you know, modern formats, recorded by non-experts in the field. And it's kind of amazing what happens sometimes on these field recordings, but they are typically not similar. Oh, and one other point, that our goal in a research archive is long-term preservation. That's our primary focus. That's the lens through which we look at these kinds of questions. Not that broadcast archives are not concerned with long-term preservation. I think many of them are. But they may not be quite as squarely focused on this goal. When doing parallel transfers, many people believe that there is a greater risk. That is, the engineer is not giving 100% attention to any given source. And so there's the risk that the engineer is going to miss something, and something's going to go wrong and you're never going to notice it. Our objectives in doing this research and development for Sound Directions: to develop a safe application for research archives specifically, who are using, as we are in our setting, low-cost, non-turnkey systems. To have a high degree of confidence that this output is preservation worthy. And then to develop strategies to mitigate the risk. Again, particularly because we have collections that tend to not be, well, they can be similar or they may not be similar. Let's just say that there are often surprises. We've used a variety of setups. The one that I'll refer to most often is what we call our 3x2 parallel mono. These are playing two groups of three cassette decks. And the way this works, it's no great mystery here. The engineer preps three cassettes and then begins digitizing all three at once, and then turns his attention to prepping the next three during the transfer. When the first bank of cassettes finishes, then the engineer starts the second bank, goes back to the first, flips the tape, and keeps going from there. And this is our studio here, which I'll actually come back to in a minute. That slide's a little dark, a little bit difficult to see. We found two areas in which we felt it would be very fruitful to work at mitigating risk for the kinds of materials that we have. One is the selection process, what many people call triage, and the second is monitoring. And we'll talk about selection first. The goal of selection at this point in the workflow is to assign recordings to a one-to-one custom transfer workflow, or to assign recordings in batches to parallel transfer. And the material that goes through the parallel transfer workflow stream, we want to arrange in batches that are as like as possible to keep transfer moving forward efficiently. Now, there are some formats that we automatically assign to a one-to-one transfer. We are not capable of handling disks in a parallel transfer workflow, so they automatically go through one-to-one. Cylinders, wires, half-mil tapes, any tapes that exhibit problems, cassettes with noise reduction all require special handling, at least for us. And we've begun to think that material that is extremely well-recorded and of very high research value, you know, great fidelity, great stuff, great documentation, perhaps needs to go through a custom one-to-one. You might think that that would be easy to send through a parallel transfer workflow, and it may be, but these are the kinds of materials that maybe we want to pay 100% attention to so that they have a long life with as full fidelity as possible. That leaves us a couple of candidates within our own shop for parallel transfer: open reel audio tapes and analog audio cassettes. So we're looking for homogeneous collections. And we're also looking, not always, but particularly for collections which may have somewhat lower research value, materials that we want to digitize that we perhaps don't want to expend as many resources on. First step in the selection process is a visual inspection of a collection, which is done by a project assistant, not by the project engineer. And the goal here is to assess the suitability for parallel transfer and then to create these preliminary parallel transfer batches of like materials. The project assistant is looking at tape brands and tape bases, visible problems, collection documentation, looking at the content. What is it, spoken? Is it spoken word? Is it music based? And at this stage, we may play back a few items if we have some mysteries that we can't solve through visual inspection, and the engineer may get involved. We try to limit this as much as possible. The primary criteria that the project assistant has been using for date to create batches are tape brands, tape lengths, and spoken word or music. So we try to group all the tape brands together. So for example, with cassettes, all of your major manufacturers like TDK and Maxell may all get grouped into one. If we have some off-brand cassettes within the same collection, which often happens, the off-brands, because they're a little less consistent, perhaps carry a bit of greater risk, may get placed into another batch. Tape lengths, C60s, C90s, for example, and then spoken word and music. The next step is a playback inspection by the engineer. So the engineer is taking these preliminary parallel transfer batches and is in the studio. Transfer is going on with one bank of cassettes, and the engineer is assessing the next three up. The goal here is to say, okay, this is appropriate for parallel transfer, or toss it aside and say, this really needs to be looked at more carefully. We'll put it in a one-to-one, or at least we'll take some time and take a closer look at it. The engineer is doing everything that you would expect to prep a tape for transfer. So inspecting, diagnosing problems, exercising the tape, setting azimuth, setting levels. We've clearly made some workflow choices here. We thought originally that we might combine the visual and the playback inspection, but we ultimately decided that it takes too much time. Well, what we really decided was this would need to be done by the audio engineer because it involved playback and, you know, very detailed examination of the recording. And we needed to use the audio engineer for what engineers are trained to do, which is to actually do the transfer, use technical and critical listening skills. And that, in fact, we could save some time by doing the visual inspection with the project assistant, with the engineer then following up. We also felt if we were going to take the time to wind the tape, set azimuth, set levels, rather than taking notes on that process to be used later when we come back to a batch, that really that's the time to press play and to really get it going. So this is the reason for the two stages of inspection. The next area that I want to talk about in terms of mitigating risk for parallel transfers is monitoring protocols. And we were not happy with the kinds of monitoring that we had heard about from others who were doing parallel transfers. Either the engineer manually switching from source to source when it's time, or the procedure of listening to all of the sources kind of at equal levels at full strength at the same time, usually placed in different speakers. We wanted to try to find something that was a little more, not only efficient, but a little safer, I would say. Our goals here, the first one's very commonsensical, to monitor every source as much as possible. Second, we wanted to switch automatically between sources and then have a primary focus on one source, but be able to hear all of them. Quick identification of a playback machine from listening, so there, if there's a problem, you can know exactly, you can know very quickly what machine the problem comes from. And then being able to quickly focus on one source if there are problems. Here's how we accomplished some of this. Automated switching between sources. Here we're relying on software to do the switching, not the engineer. What we wanted to avoid was the engineer having to remember to switch, saying, oh, okay, it's been 2 minutes or however long time to switch to the next source. And so what we essentially are doing is using software to force the engineer's attention from one source to the other at a predefined interval. In terms of quick idea of playback machine from listening and then a primary focus on one source but hearing all of them, I'll show you a couple of slides that will demonstrate this, but just to quickly say, we have a physical correspondence between the playback machines and the speakers, which I'll show you in just a moment. And then also here, in terms of the monitoring protocol we're using, I need to credit our friends in Australia, colleagues at IATSIS, who were using a Pro Tools monitoring scheme to automatically switch between different sources. we have significantly further extended and developed this and really made it our own. So back to this relatively dark slide. We have three cassette decks here. Top deck is routed to the left speaker. Middle, routed to the middle speaker. Right is routed to the right speaker. Remember that these are mono cassettes. And same thing on the left-hand side, left, middle, and right. So if something happens, we have some physical alignment that can help us find out which deck is throwing the problem. And in terms of monitoring, actually I'll go back to here. What we're hearing is a primary focus on one cassette deck, but we're still hearing the others. That primary focus means that one cassette deck is about 15 dB louder than the others, but you still hear the others in the background. So if my focus is on the left, is on the top deck here, it's in the left speaker, it's 15 dB louder, I can hear the other sources in the middle and in the right. If something drastic happens on those other sources, I'll hear that. And I'm able to focus my attention right here. After about 6 seconds, the focus will switch to the middle deck. This will be 15 dB louder. The other two will still be there. And after 6 seconds, it will switch to here. It will continue to loop throughout the entire playback. Now, 6 seconds may seem like a very small amount of time, particularly to engineers. And I think our engineers felt that that was a very short period of time as well. But as they worked with different intervals, you know, greater and smaller, they found that they preferred 6 seconds. What they tell me is that it keeps them engaged in the content of all three sources, and that no one source is out of their hearing for more than 15 seconds. So they actually find that this very small period of time works quite well for their purposes. This is the Pro Tools, just a screenshot from the Pro Tools session that's running the monitoring scheme. This is unrelated to the recording chain, of course. You can very quickly focus on one source if you hear a problem and hear just that source. You can also very quickly hear all three sources as well. Here you'll see that the physical alignment was not enough for us. We also wanted to be able to see visually when the source switched from one deck to the next. So we have LEDs on each deck, and they switch when the primary focus switches. So again, if you hear a problem, you can look at which deck is lit up and very quickly know where that problem is occurring on what deck. The one-to-one workflow is often held up as the gold standard for preservation transfer. We decided to take just a step back from that and ask ourselves, are there any risks in the one-to-one workflow? And are there any corresponding advantages to doing parallel transfers? Well, here's the picture that I'll paint for you. You're an audio engineer. You're in the studio. It's usually in a basement for some reason. It's very dark. You're facing 4 or more weeks of cassettes. They're 45 minutes a side. They're in a language that you don't understand. There's lots of downtime when doing a one-to-one transfer. There's the potential for disengagement. The engineers say, well, I'll just keep one ear on the transfer and maybe I'll do this. Or maybe I'll do this. Ouch. Hope I'm not going to do too much of this. These things happen in my experience. What we found is that doing parallel transfers demands your attention. It's sonically and intellectually engaging. You have to pay attention or else you get lost very quickly. Our engineers say, yes, this is more demanding, but it also is more rewarding in many ways because they're engaging more deeply with the content. We found some other workflow advantages in doing parallel transfers as well. It's very easy to detect shifts in fidelities. The common scenario is you're working with a collection at a time. So you have 3 cassettes recorded by the same person during the same field trip, probably recorded within a few days of each other. They sound very similar. If you start hearing some differences on one of those tapes, you have 2 other cassettes running at the same time that you can compare it to. With a one-to-one transfer, the scenario is more like you think you're hearing differences. You're thinking to yourself, what did it sound like 10 minutes ago? You're thinking, what did that cassette sound like yesterday? And you're trying to figure out if you're really hearing a difference. Maybe you have some software tools to help you look at, providing frequency analysis, for example. But even so, it can be very difficult to remember how something sounded. In this situation, you have two other things running. You very quickly hear differences in fidelity. Very similarly, you can detect shifts in the signal chain very quickly because you have two other signal chains going at the same time. It's easy to take problem tapes, which, you put a cassette in and it's not playing very well in one machine. Maybe you have some physical restoration to do. Or maybe it just will play better in another machine for reasons that you can't predict. You have two other machines up and ready to go right then that you can try out that cassette on. So you can quickly troubleshoot. We also found that it's a very efficient way to handle short sides. You have a 45-minute side. After 5 minutes, the content stops. It appears that there's 40 minutes of blank tape. What do you do? Do you stop and say you're done? Not if you work in a research archive, because often there's content further down the line, kind of very surprising ways. And so do you then listen through, doing a one-to-one transfer, you listen through completely and have 40 minutes of downtime? Or do you spot check and run the risk of missing something? If you're in a parallel transfer workflow, you have two other cassettes that are still running, typically. So you just let that third one that seems to have stopped run all the way through. You're 100% confident that you've gotten, that there's nothing else on that tape, and you're still working efficiently because you have two other cassettes that are running. Productivity gains. I have some figures. This is for a different setup. This is running two cassettes at a time. What we're looking here is looking at is hours of engineer time to transfer and do metadata entry for 1 hour of content. In a one-to-one workflow for us, it's 1.4 to 1. That may seem a little low. We have some automation in running here that, we have software applications that are doing a lot of our metadata collection and the other small tasks that we need to do. With parallel transfer workflow, we've been able to get this down to 0.65 to 1. So that's a 115% increase in productivity, which we find is significant. Are there other ways in which we might gain some productivity? Well, there's the idea of reverse playback, which is basically transferring two tracks simultaneously, but in this case, the two tracks exist on the same tape. So you're digitizing one forwards and one backwards at the same time. Let's take a look at this. Here is an open reel tape recorded half track mono. This is track number one being recorded. One edge of the tape is oriented up to the top of the playback head. Here's that second tape recording side B or side two, track two. And here's track two with, again, one edge oriented up to the top of the playback head. Here is track one already recorded, traveling backwards, and that edge that was at the top is now oriented to the bottom of the playback head because you flipped the tape, and this is what happens physically. So here's the common scenario when you're doing reverse playback. You're back to track one, oriented in the original direction, but track two, traveling backwards, now has that top edge, which when it was recorded was at the top, is now oriented downwards. Is that an issue? Well, we need to ask ourselves a couple of questions, and these are squarely preservation questions. This is, the lens through which we analyze these kinds of things. And if preservation is not your major concern, then these questions may not be as applicable. What are the technical consequences of reproducing a magnetic track of audio content backwards and upside down from its original direction and orientation? And are the results from reverse playback equivalent to forward playback? Well, with some variables, it's a non-issue. Frequency response, harmonic distortion, wow and flutter, forward equals reverse in our testing. There are, however, some problems, or I should say some differences. One is inverted polarity. The reverse material, the material that was digitized in reverse, will be inverted in polarity. And this is not because the track is being played backwards, it's because of the switch in physical orientation. This, of course, is correctable in software. Here are just a few waveforms from many, many, many that we generated during testing. This is your input signal here from an oscillator. This is as coming off of tape with forward playback. Here's the waveform. This is reverse playback so that the tape is inverted in physical position. This file has been digitally reproduced in the computer, but you can see that we have an inverted polarity. Instead of the crest going up, they're now going down. And here we have corrected the polarity in the computer. Some things still look a little bit different with this waveform. And that's because we found that there are also apparently different phase distortion products between forward and reverse playback. And you can see that here. Forward playback, if you look at the crests here, you can see that the crests look a little bit different here. And this, again, is a file that's been digitally reversed with polarity corrected. And we think this is, now, this was done on a Studer A810, which is a phase-compensated machine, which may be playing into this as well. Not all open reel tape machines are phase-compensated, but some are. Here's a square wave. Again, forward playback and then reverse playback with polarity. The file digitally reversed, polarity corrected. This waveform looks quite a bit different than this one. Something clearly is going on here, and to be honest, we don't fully understand yet what it is. We understand enough to think that this is not, that this is a full-fledged year or two-year grant-funded R&D project that somebody needs to do. I don't think it's going to be us, to further understand what exactly is going on when you do reverse playback. So we have chosen at this time at the Archives of Traditional Music not to use this technique. We just simply don't understand the differences that we're seeing between forward and reverse. And just one further thing, the results of our research will be published on the Sound Directions website later on this year. Thank you very much.